This is the Lean Into Art Cast. Whether it's illustration, cartooning, UI design, or presenting, it all comes down to telling your story, communicating your ideas. It takes a lot of effort and curiosity, but let's lean into it.
So, but Jersey, we're not recording video then, right?
Correct. This will be audio only.
Same page, but we're going for those smooth tones. All right.
Smooth tones. This one's to sound richer. So, ready to lean into it?
I'm ready.
Okay. So, hey, you know what? There's an example I like to use a lot in other podcast things that I've done and in my classrooms to demonstrate an idea. And that runs as follows. And I probably already used it on Lean Into Art. Now that I think about it, Rob, if you walk up to somebody in the street, you say, "Hey, tell me a story." They go, but if you walk up to them and you say, "Tell me a story about your 7th birthday party," suddenly you can get somewhere a lot faster, right? Working with those limitations gets you to be able to convey an idea much more quickly, correct?
Absolutely.
Well, I shouldn't say correct. I said, do you agree?
I agree 100%.
This is a different kind of pedagogy we're talking about here. I'm not talking about, yes or no, one or zero. We're talking about, are we generally in the same area of thinking? Does that sound fair? I remember the day when I remember the time when I discovered that learning was actually a pretty cool thing to do. And it's funny, I think about this a lot because I get into arguments sometimes with people about the word education and the word learning as being like, that's a bad word to use. That's like saying dieting. That's like saying like to eat your vegetables, because nobody wants to actually think about learning or education. That's work. That's the pill you got to take, but you got to sweeten the pill with fun. So you got to sell them on how it's going to be exciting. It's going to be interesting. It's going to be really cool, but you're also going to be learning, you know? And even in like the kids cartoons that I love to study, And I use the word seriously, study. One of the talks I want to do for Lean Into Art is a breakdown of how, if you really analyze kids' cartoons, you can find a really great way to examine a structural way to think about your writing. But anyway, is that even in them, they like slip the learning in under the radar. You know, we're watching a bunch of giant robots fight, but you're learning something too, you know? But I remember...
It's the fortified cereal, right? Where you've got it's a box of chocolate clowns that also has 8 essential vitamins.
Well, chocolate clowns might be, that's like a recipe to terrify children.
It depends, you know, maybe if there were teddy bears or something, right?
Or if they were
less threatening.
If you're aiming the cereal at like ironic hipsters, maybe, or something like that, but.
Oh, sure. There'd be like chocolate license plates or something.
You look at like Kix, kid tested, mother approved, right? Like the kids love it because it tastes good, but mom's like it because it's got vitamins, right? Yeah, that's exactly the kind of thinking. And so when I was a teenager and into my early 20s, I hated reading. I hated it. I hated the idea of reading books. I remember reading Great Expectations in 11th grade and it was just torture. And we started watching like a BBC television series based on Great Expectations. I was like, why don't we just do this? This is so much better than reading the book. Oh, reading a book, awful. And then something clicked when I was in my early 20s and I suddenly loved the idea of reading. I suddenly realized the connection of its usefulness to me, that it wasn't just about entertainment. It wasn't just about learning. It had a direct benefit to me in some way. And it was when I started reading books on mythology and literature and like how literature works, and then moving on to reading literature, that I realized that, oh, if I understand this stuff, it's going to make me a better cartoonist. It's going to make me a better storyteller overall. And then all of a sudden the floodgates were open. I couldn't read enough. When I was in my early 20s and I worked as a blackjack dealer in a casino, the way it works is, at least at the casino I worked at, you work for an hour and then you get a 15 to 20 minute break every hour. And so you get a lot of breaks throughout the shift. And especially I was working like a weekend shift where I worked like 10 hour shifts. So there's a lot of break time for you to, you know, do whatever. And I would always read. And I remember a guy saying to me across the break room, like, "Man, Jersey, I always see you reading." And I said, yeah, you know, I like it. And he said, with almost the guileless pride of that you can only find in certain parts of the state of Michigan, he said, I haven't read a book in 2 years. And it's not to say that I became like a reading enthusiast to where I could read anything. It's not like the guy from the Twilight Zone episode Time Enough at Last, where it's like, you know, I'm even reading like milk cartons or something, you know, because I just always have to be consuming information. But I was persnickety about what I would consume. But it's that I realized that the value was there. And so when I went to college, this came back to bite me in the butt. I was taking a Chinese religion class as part of my undergrad study in like humanities, folklore, mythology kind of stuff, like all hippies do. And I was doing a paper on the poem Basho's Pond. And you know that one?
I do not.
It's the frog jumps in the pond, plop. It's one of the, it's like a really short poem by I think Basho was the poet. But it was like picking apart what's the meaning of this poem and like what's, you know, what was he trying to convey and like how did he do it simply? And anyway, so, you know, I brought in the notes from the instructor's talk into my paper, but then I also brought in other resources. Like I brought in writings from Zhuangzi and I brought in writings from other Chinese religion sources from books that I had read outside of the class, outside of the syllabus. And I got marked down. I got marked down on that paper, and he said, you know, like these observations aren't exactly, you know, pertinent to the discussion, blah, blah, blah. And so I think I got like a C on the paper. The next paper I did, I wrote an essay on another Chinese poem, and I just reiterated exactly verbatim what the instructor had said in class, like note for note. And I got A+, and he put great observation on the paper. So that was an instance where this is where like I kind of got soured on college because I was like, wow, really? You're going to mark me down because I did extra research on this paper and answered, you know, like brought in like, you know, demonstrating the fact. And I wasn't trying to show off. I was just trying to say like, I'm really interested in this subject. And here's some other readings that I did in the subject that I'm bringing into this. No, you did bad. Repeat what I said. You did good. So when did it change for you and how did it change?
Well, it's funny because I know I've really geeked out over learning forever just because, I mean, I've actually had a fun time reading, and that's typically what, you know, much like in your story, that reading is just such a core critical activity for gaining knowledge that it just gets kind of associated with the whole learning process so completely, right? Where and then even to the negative extent when you can have, you know, maybe mixed experiences or not so good experiences, some teachers maybe not jiving with where you're at, or maybe you're, you know, just not jiving with where they're at, and then somehow associating that with reading. But that never really happened to me, where in not surprisingly, it's kind of related to computers that where I think like this really big spark in my past that got me extra hyped about reading. There was a few of us kids in class in second grade, and we were in some kind of group. I'm sure it was, you know, I don't know what we did that was, you know, exceptional at that point, because everything else lost all, you know, importance in my memory, except we got to go play with computers, right? And so we go to this room that's attached to the library, and they had a lab of Atari 400s and 800s, right? Which if you're not familiar, the Atari 800 has the keyboard that goes clack, 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 clack. It's super loud. And the Atari 400 has a keyboard that goes tunk, tunk, like a McDonald's membrane cash register. And
Is kind of a dated reference.
it is, I know. Because what's that? It's a touchscreen now, right?
Right. It's going to be an iPad in a couple of years.
Oh, yeah. It's not. Yeah, that's funny. I wonder if you could get an add-on of a capacitive membrane pad to relive the experience on your iPad. Right? I bet that's doable. Yeah. I was excited. I mean, I sat on an 800 or 400, so it took me longer to type stuff in, but I didn't care because we were playing. And pretty quickly there was some guy that was not really part of the staff of the school or whatnot, but he was there to teach us how to program, right? And he actually had us come away from the computers. And I was like, oh, man, you know, that's what this is for. I want to play. And I don't know what I'm doing, but that's all right. I'm causing stuff to happen on the screen. And what he did is he brought up a loaf of bread and a jar of peanut butter and a knife. And he said, I want you to program me how to make a sandwich. And I was like, what? How do we do that? It's the computers are over there. Sandwich, that doesn't connect. I don't know. This is funny. You're a silly guy and this is fun, right? But then someone just said, well, you make the sandwich, right? And he's like, oh, what's that? And you just started juggling the bread and just doing stuff, you know?
Yeah.
Push the jar over and, you know, and we're like, well, wait. First you have to get, you know, got to get the bread out of the bag, right? Silly. And he's like, oh, okay. So first I have to do this. And so what he was teaching us, like a way to analyze this task and repeat it back to him, because that's what we have to do to tell the computer what to do.
Yeah.
And I just want to say thank you to that guy. So, I don't know his name, but yeah, that really, anyway.
He abstracted the why. Right?
He did, yeah.
And he found a metaphor for you to say, you know, this is why you have to be so explicit in your language when you're talking to this thing.
Mm-hmm. And he did all sorts of fun stuff. I mean, he messed up like 10 sandwiches, right? Doing silly things and getting bread stuck to his hand and whatever. I mean, but you were exactly. And in doing so, it was such a fun but tangible example that, you know, he helped us get through it. And yeah. And I think maybe that not only taught me how awesome learning is, because you don't have to do it. You can do it by experiencing and thinking about stuff and seeing what happened. Not that I even knew that at that time. Right.
Right.
It affected me.
Right. Yeah. It learning is a mode of thinking and investigating something rather than memorizing and repeating something. Do you think people even think about it that way anymore? I mean, I don't know what's been going on. I don't keep my ear to the tracks in terms of like what discussions are happening in modern education circles, but it seems like we're still in a world where, like, at least in the American education system, where no child left behind, standards-based education, everything has to be measured. A lot of it is stuff that's still to this day very much like memorize how to do this thing and then demonstrate that you've memorized how to do this thing.
Yeah, it's tough because you really, when you build systems and, you know, learning, a system of just disseminating learning is no different. You have to measure it somehow. And then you inherently end up affecting the activities you go about because of how you're measuring them. And so, I mean, and by all means, I'm totally not an educational system expert. I've just been playing around and, you know, reading a few interesting things recently in that area, that my impression is that initiatives like No Child Left Behind are a catalyst to figure out, well, how do we get good learning and have it map to that reporting and accountability, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think some places are coming up with good creative ways to do it, and others are kind of, you know, hurting and stuck, where it's sort of a too literal of a translation of, oh, okay, I'm going to be measured in this way. How do I literally, you know, go through steps to get that outcome when it's just not that kind of a problem domain, right? It's not like you're manufacturing a pack of gum. You're sharing an idea with a person, and you want to make sure that they understand that. But of course, everyone understands things in different ways, and so you come across learning frameworks that are trying to address all those different problems. Like, oh, everyone has different modalities of learning, and we can map people beginning to learn who are hands-on, or people who are really advanced and very visual, or et cetera, with this final measurement in this way. But there's a whole lot of steps in between.
Yeah. And then even another layer on top of that is teaching the how as well as the why, right? So like not only speaking to like a whole bunch of different kinds of learners in the room, but also taking care, like your instructor did, by demonstrating through metaphor this idea of this is why you have to be explicit in this language. So now you're better equipped to understand when I give you these instructions on how to do it, you know why you're doing it while you're doing the how. you know?
Yeah. What an awesome example to have experienced, at least for me. Me, that sounds boring or lame to others, but I mean, cause it's computers or whatnot, but that why is, it's just so cool. I don't know.
There was the
whoever's friend he was in the school got him to come in. That's just so cool.
No, that's super awesome. That's something I'm going to keep on my mind as I'm demonstrating concepts in a classroom. Is, you know, like another thing that I think about when I'm doing workshops and things is trying not to rely too much on PowerPoint, because it can easily just turn into a list of information for people, right? And that harkens back to the idea of memorize these facts. Even if I'm demonstrating like kind of abstract concepts, but like, you know, it's like you've been watching Lawrence Lessig lately.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, this guy, his PowerPoint is just there to like sort of abstract a general idea that he's talking about. So you're listening to the words, and then he's got a picture there that does like sort of an abstract metaphor of what he's talking about. A lot of the time, sometimes the slides will be a word that he's using as a transition, right? Like what next or how, you know, in his brackets, he's always got them in brackets / end. But yeah, this is a guy who really understands how to use PowerPoint, because he'll use it often to create a metaphor for what he's talking about visually. It's sort of like to accompany this thought that he's trying to convey, right?
Yeah, I think he's trying to draw extra connections to the concept, both with his example and his argument, right? So I think he's operating on a few different levels at once.
Yeah,
and having them reinforce one another, and overall making it both flow well as you hear it or consume his presentation, but then with these blips and these highlights that stick out in your head, like you mentioned, like, well, he throws in those transitions, and it's not always a just a conjunction or something that just doesn't mean anything. He'll hit one word, make it red, and then put brackets around it, and so actually there's the progression of where the concept animates also. Right. And it's subtle too. I mean, he does it a lot where it's not just, oh, now we transition slide left and now we transition slide up. It's let's see, one word in the paragraph stays on the page, rest of the paragraph fades out. That word goes red, then the brackets go around it, then it goes white, then it goes next. You know what I mean? Where
mm-hmm.
he's actually, and he's not even drawing much attention to that, except like on one presentation, he had what was it? Was it the White House or the Capitol building that showed up? And he actually broke the fourth wall and like said, he was really proud of that because he made it. It's funny. I was like, okay. He's operating on multiple levels. Like he even stepped outside the presentation to talk about the presentation, which only, it gives you these packets or chunks that you can make that he's offering that you have a chance to then ingest, versus like one big string of, here's all I have. It's a bunch of slides, a bunch of words.
Mm-hmm.
No ebb and flow.
You know, I also think about how when I fell in love with the act of reading, it was a completely selfish act. I was doing it out of a sense of this, I'm on a quest to find answers to get better at a thing, right? And it became a very personal thing. I want to beat this thing. I want to be as good as I can be as a storyteller, cartoonist, whatever. And it wasn't about getting the good grade so I could show off, look at what I did, teacher, or look what I did, mom, I got a good report card. It wasn't that kind of showing off. It was a showing off of, I suddenly, the idea of, and maybe this is something that, maybe I was just a late bloomer. You know, maybe this is something where it's like, I should have developed this at the age of 15, but I didn't. But by the time I was like 21, suddenly it was concretized in my head of like, the act of reading wasn't just a pleasurable experience in and of itself, because that was also about the time I started to really start to appreciate language, like reading, like, you know, 19th century authors and really enjoying wordplay and things like that. But also just like getting to the bottom of ideas and really starting to pick things apart and analyze them, like what I was supposed to be doing when I was reading Great Expectations. But I couldn't do it for some reason because all I could do was just go, oh, God, it's a bunch of words. And it's about a poor kid who is sad because he loves this girl who will never be his. And he doesn't know who his benefactor is. Whoop-de-doo. You know, I was reading comic books at the time, and I was more interested in what was going on in Spectacular Spider-Man. You know, that was much more dramatic, in my opinion. Although, you know, I think about it and I go back. I did really enjoy Greek mythology when I was that age, though. I really liked it a lot. And I remember, like, that was one of the few, like, lit assignments I got good grades on was I did a comic book adaptation of what would happen if, like, the Greek gods were still worshipped today. Like, what would they look like?
There's a lot of parallels between comic world, you know, yeah, modern gods and all that.
Sure, yeah. But anyway, you know, it's like once it became a selfish act, once it became like, oh, this is for me to benefit, and I know how I'm going to benefit, and I understand the why it's important to do this. It didn't become vitamins anymore. It turned into this was my junk food. This was something that I did purely for pleasure to understand it, because I really developed a passion for unboxing it. And that was something where I didn't have a whole lot of teaching or learning experiences in school that really lent itself to developing that attitude in me. You know, I had teachers I liked, like the one math class. I'll disclose something. I flunked out of algebra 2, and it was like the one class I ever flunked. And as a matter of fact, on my final exam, I wrote an essay instead of answering the questions. I wrote an essay promising my algebra 2 teacher that I would never use any of this information in my practical life as an adult. It was my refutation of everything he was trying to teach me. And I was basically giving him the finger saying, you think you're teaching something? F you. I'm going to make a life for myself despite that you think this is important, you know? But geometry.
And you got an F for that, huh?
Yeah. I flunked the class. The teacher was a jerk too, on the other hand, because I remember I fell asleep in class once and I woke up because somebody tapped me on the shoulder and he was doing some kind of like mocking dance in front of me instead of waking me up.
Sure.
he had a personal issue with me, but anyway. But geometry, on the other hand, I got A+ in geometry class. I got to the point where in that class where the teacher actually called my parents to say how awesome I was, and I think part of it was because geometry has a completely different thing than algebra 2 or pre-calc or whatever. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was mostly like solving logic riddles of like, if X is this, then Y must be this, and you look, you know, bisect the angle, whatever. But also because I think the teacher kind of presented it in a, he called, and everybody groaned when he did this, but I thought it was terrific. He called, what do you call a thing when it's not a test? It's like a pretest. It's like a
challenge and exploration.
Yeah. There's like a real
quiz.
Word. Yeah. Like quiz. Thank you. Yes. He called quizzes scrimmages and he called tests games. And he said, like, okay, so we got a game next week, and so it's time to bone up on our strategies for our game, you know?
Right.
And that simple word choice and that simple attitude towards the content made it feel completely different to me as a kid. And then plus I got along with the teacher and I enjoyed the content. But like, how night and day is that? You flunk algebra 2, you get A+ in geometry. There's gotta be something there that's going on that's different in both environments, right?
Oh yeah. It's not like you're exercising that different of mental muscles, so to speak, on the different topics. I mean, chances are there's, a different experience or relationship with a teacher or whatever going on.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. The renaming, reframing of it, right?
Yeah.
Where, some things aren't always compatibly reframable, but, I don't know. I think learning has a lot of flexibility in it. I've been, this year I've had some experience working with the idea of gamification, right? And I've been, you know, reading different things where teachers are bringing games into the classroom. And an example of that renaming that I've seen, and it sounds really fun, honestly, gets me excited even, you know, reading about them doing it, is sometimes tests are boss battles, right?
Oh yeah, there you go.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So you can have classes that are facilitated in such a way where they actually have a metagame aspect to it. So how you play it can, you will be measured on how you play it, but of course how you play it will also affect your chances of being a better learner of it.
Yep.
Right?
things leveling like, up. Leveling up is language exactly. that gets kicked around everywhere, right? I mean, it's yeah. part of the common language nowadays. I
interesting.
I think about that too. Like when in my Algebra 2 class, that was he was the kind of teacher where he'd call you up to the board to solve the problem when he knew you couldn't do it. And it was just a humiliation. And like, I would audibly groan. Like he'd be like, oh, why don't you come up and do this? I'd be like, oh, you know, I can't do it. So why are you doing this to me? You're just making this whole experience worse for everybody. Because now the kids got to watch me sit there and stare at a chalkboard, you know? Whereas the geometry class where he treated it like a game and a scrimmage, he'd be like, all right, let's hustle. Who wants to be the first to take this one on? You know, like for him, it was like getting us fired up to take on the challenge rather than punishing us for not being prepared to take on the challenge. You know what I mean?
Oh yeah. No, they're two different models of reinforcement and yeah. incentive, right? Encouragement and excitement toward taking on a possible challenge and sort of self-nominating to come into it versus humiliation and yeah. punishment. You know, take it on or be humiliated. Yeah, I had teachers of that regard or that style.
Yeah,
but, yeah.
So, I mean, when we go back to this idea of challenges, this leads me to a segue. Art challenges. You know, we talked a little bit on the past Lean Into Art podcasts about like possibly wanting to run art challenges in addition to workshops through mm-hmm. the Lean Into Art site. Is there a value to doing public challenges? You know, like I was watching on Google Plus and Karsten Bradley, who's a guy that people should follow on Google Plus, he's been doing a series of art challenges where he just throws out like two random things, got to put them together. So like Saturday morning cartoon characters or 80s cartoon characters mixed with fish. Go. And then people are posting all these different reactions. Somebody posts, you know, like here's like a Thundercat as a hammerhead shark. Here's like, Marshall Brave Star as a starfish. Making whatever kind of connections you can and then just posting the pictures publicly and letting it turn into a thread of discussion where everybody just gets to have fun drawing something silly, but then also gets to, you know, create like a sort of like a, I don't know what happens when you do that. Let me just ask you, like what happens when you do a public art challenge like that?
Well, let's see. It's a, let's see, you're bringing together a group of people that want to, they're probably motivated to learn, but then having the chances, there's nothing that stops you from getting up every day and saying, I'm going to learn 100 things today, right? But then what things and when and why and how? But our challenges end up sort of crystallizing that in a pretty interesting package for some people. I know I'm kind of an addict sometimes to art challenges. They provide this situation where, okay, a group of people are going to have this shared experience, right? And you're going to share this limitation and just see what you all do about it. And you can talk about it and present and interact. Right. So all of a sudden you have a reason to kick off conversations with people that maybe you haven't met before. So it's a good social experience. It's also a chance to try new things. Well, maybe you don't normally draw 80s characters, right?
Right.
And or maybe
Maybe you've never decided that you ever wanted to draw a starfish, you know?
Exactly. So all of a sudden now you're looking up reference material for a starfish and you're looking up reference material for these 80s characters and you're doing stuff that maybe you subscribe to like a magazine like Imagine Effects, right? So you see someone doing character design or you follow character design blogs of various artists. But this gives you a reason to do it yourself and you know, go for it and adjust the challenge to whatever level you want where you say, oh, and guess what? I'm really wanting to pursue a new line art style. Okay, cool. I'm going to use the Pentel pocket brush pen for this or whatever. And so you can combine all these things because of this context of a challenge, right? Or make it as simple or as complicated as you want. All because instead of getting up in the morning and having like the infinite world of possibilities trying to map to, I'm going to learn 100 things today versus knowing this one specific thing you're going to go at with whatever you have to bring to it. and say, I bet I'm going to learn 100 things from trying to draw this starfish Marshall Bravestar character, right?
Did you do that on purpose, roping it back into that idea at the top about like the tell me a story or tell me a story about your 7th birthday party? If you did, you're good. Take credit.
I call it immersive learning, but I'm not actually thinking much at all. It's you know, I'm more like the whale where, you know what, I'm swimming through the ocean of info. No, whatever, I don't know. And I'm influenced it, but yeah.
But yeah, I mean, that comes back to the whole idea. Like, I'm going to get up this morning, I'm going to learn 100 things. Like, you talk about earlier about, like, falling in love with this idea of learning or reading or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, where am I going to start? What am I going to do? I mean, there's too many choices. You go to the bookstore. I want to learn about something. You're going to be overwhelmed. You know, you go on Google. I want to learn about character design. Well, where do I start? Well, and then you create, like, this, like, mm-hmm. simple activity that gets you hip deep in it and also exposes you probably to things that you never even thought you'd want to draw, releases your inhibitions in terms of trying out new techniques and new styles. You know, like I've talked about this a lot in my past, like as a freelance illustrator, is like my freelance jobs are where I do all my experimentation because I'm not as invested in the way it's ultimately going to be received by an audience. I just care about getting paid. If the client's happy, I'm happy, you know? If it's a huge staggering success with fans, not quite as important as if it's something that I own, right? There's a lot more incentive there to please an audience when you're doing your own thing. So you feel a little bit more cautious, less eager to experiment sometimes, or you can fall into that trap at any rate. If you're a person who bravely experiments, good for you. And I mean that sincerely. I you know, as an aside, whenever I say good for you to people, a lot of people react very negatively to that. They think I'm being insincere.
Really? It sounded like you said nice hair to me. I'm totally kidding. No, you know, it's sincere. It's I had a little guffaw kind of stifled there because all that stuff, it's very it's exciting. I get caught up in all that excitement. And I love to jump in.
Yeah, and then when you get hip deep in that stuff, you're gonna discover something about character design that you maybe didn't even intend on learning, but the whole point is to learn something, right? Mm-hmm. And then, but like I love what you pointed out about that social aspect too, because that is another hard one. And they do this at all the Ignite talks. So I did that Ignite talk back in July, and every one of them they start off with this icebreaker event. And the first one I did, it was a paper rock scissors competition. Mm-hmm. Where everybody in the audience had to do paper, rock, scissors with the person next to them and then eliminate the audience down to like the top five people. Like, okay, here, you know, it would do a round again and again and again. And every time you lose, you have to sit down. And so then finally you whittle the audience down to five people. Then they all do it up on the stage at the end to win a prize. And it's a way for you to like meet the people next to you in the audience. So they're not strangers mm-hmm. anymore. And then it kind of lightens the attitude, lightens the mood, so to speak. Because yeah, I mean like, what's harder than approaching a stranger and striking up a conversation? I mean, even online.
Yeah, it's not very natural. I mean, the having some reason to exchange ideas is it's pretty helpful. Otherwise, it can be easily perceived as just spam, right? It's unwanted contact.
Yeah, we were talking about this earlier. Just before we started recording with like, I've been getting emails from people who are sharing their thoughts on the Art and Story podcast now that it has concluded. And like a lot of these people I've never heard from before, you know, but they have all these wonderful things to say. And you had a really great observation on that and like why they would wait till now to say something about it.
Well, I think, from personal experience and also from thinking about things from like a user experience guy angle, right?
Yeah, I should say that you're not saying that this is specifically why these people did what they did, why they responded, but you had a theory on why.
Yeah, exactly. It's a theory, right? It's easy to have an emotional reaction to something online, right? I mean, if you're rather pleased or rather displeased, it may be easy to just sort of tweet about it or share that something, that emotional impression and then the emotional reaction. But I would think that with Art and Story, with all the how deep a lot of the content would be and for how many, how the volume of all the content. And I would not be surprised. I consider myself in the population of pretty analytical artists that listen to Art and Story. And I didn't really email in that often, right?
Right.
But the catalyst for someone who's so deeply analytical, it's less of a an easy connection between, oh, I have an analytical reaction. Am I going to now run off and do something emotional with that? Or am I just going to add that to my repository of info, right?
Right.
And just reflect on it. But now that, well, an event like, well, a podcast with that gave so much value that lasted for so long is ended. Well, that is a critical time. Here you go. Now I'm sharing some of this analysis I've had and these impressions, the feelings that I have about the analysis too.
Right.
But because I operate out of that more, less immediately reaction focused approach, well, I didn't email till now, kind of thing.
Right. And this is very analogous to striking up a conversation with a stranger too. I mean, even if that stranger is somebody who is doing something similar to what you do, they're a comics artist, you're a comics artist. What are you going to say to them? So you like comics?
Yeah, I do. Oh, cool. Well, you came to this comics event. Yep, I did.
Right, right. Yeah, you're studying the art of conversation. Yes.
Yeah, it's where obviously then there's some people in the crowd that are used to interviewing people or, you know, mixing things up a bit that are sort of really good at making connections with one another. But not everyone's that way.
Mm-hmm. Right. You know, I really am. This is another, I got a hang up that I need help with, Rob. And I know you could do it. I got a real problem with the word interview. I really do. It really bothers me so much. I think it comes out of the fact that whenever I think of the word interview, I think of like TV interview, where it's like Bryant Gumbel or, you know, Katie Couric asking really silly, pointless questions of a celebrity. Like, you know, tell me about your childhood. Where were you, a tomboy? That kind of thing.
Okay.
And so like somebody mentioned to me the other day that they really enjoy my interviewing style on the Comics Are Great show. And Well, that's a wonderful thing to hear. You know, it's cool to hear that like people enjoy the way I investigate a topic. But like I really want to be, and maybe this is semantics, but I really want the show to be defined as a conversation show, a roundtable discussion on a topic with guests, where I'm just like the facilitator of the conversation. But when somebody calls it like an interview show, I just go, I'm not an interviewer, am I? I thought I was a conversation facilitator. Or is that just pure semantics and I'm just getting uptight about something that doesn't exist?
I mean, it could be a denotation, connotation kind of problem. A little bit of, yeah, it's semantics. So, yeah, you just need to mellow a little bit, dude.
Get over it.
No, it's...
I need a suck it up jersey stinger that I can play when I do that.
There you go.
I think.
What sounds like? Let's see. You compared it to sort of like pop culture interviews where there's just not a lot of depth there or thoughtfulness. Is that what kind of?
Yeah. You know, it's like we're gonna interview Brad Pitt. It's like, oh, what's your favorite pizza? You know. Oh,
well, I mean,
really?
Think of it this way. I mean, someone who's really really smart. And incredibly, probably a group of people, should aliens that land on the planet, right?
Yeah.
Someone's going to interview them, right? I mean, would you consider that as just superfluous? And they're not going to go, nice pants.
You're right. Good for you.
Yeah. You guys weave stuff into pants. Neat. Is it? Yeah. Yeah. Anyway. Interviewing, you said the word investigation too. I mean, that's... you can investigate for whatever reason you want, right? So build some greater understanding that maps to some helpful idea, or you could just be like, yeah, you know, so you don't jump that car really far in that one movie. That was a stuntman, wasn't it?
Do you ever come up with your own lines? Do you ever come up with your own lines? Do you ever ad lib? I love that one. That's like one of my favorite groaner interview questions.
You can tell from my baloney questions I'm making up. I don't watch them.
Oh, it's like a really bad song. You know, when you hear like a really bad, annoying song and you only have to hear it once and then it's burned into your brain for the rest of your life, you know?
Oh, yeah.
So it's like that with those interviews. It's not like I watch Leonard Maltin talk to people all the time. It's just that the couple that I saw were enough to make me go, ooh, oh, the rest of my life I'm going to remember that one. but okay, challenges. Important to do, you know, get the people who participate on Lean Into Art to actually get to meet each other. So it's not to be just in a classroom environment, but like incentivize them to go off and do. I'll just say it and I'll be the lame guy because I don't mind taking that bullet. I think that we want people to get excited about the prospect of broadening their experiences and learning. Learning's not an evil word. Learning is a cool word. And in a way to do that is to get them excited about it to the point where they do it without us being there, right? Get them to do challenges on their own in the environment of the Lean Into Art site and then publicize those things and like do the kind of things like I was talking about with Carson Bradley on Google+. And other people have done this too, right? You know, he's not the only one who's ever done this. There's been lots of cartoonists who start these little kind of group events where they just draw something for fun and learn something really cool, but in the spirit of play, right?
Sure.
What can you see us doing with something like this? Any ideas that pop in your head? I'm sure you got a million ideas on how to approach something like this.
Let's see. I think having a recurring interval helps. I mean, one of the helpful limitations is forcing it to be a short time frame, because it allows people to not get, you know, caught up in too much perfectionist kind of behaviors, right? I mean, they can. I mean, everyone is welcome to, but chances are, if you really want to finish something and get it out there and get the benefit of demonstrating your grit and dedication, where you did take on the challenge and you finished it and you're sort of publicly sharing that experience with everyone, you have to accept that limitation, right?
Right.
So yeah, a tight time frame is one. And then I think we could hit a lot of different fun intersecting topics because of the nature of Lean Into Art. Mm-hmm. We don't have to just limit it to visual art sketching. I mean, we could do, you know, short prose challenges. We could do haikus, right?
Yeah.
Could do
Did you listen to Comics Are Great episode 23 yet, where I talked with Matt Madden and Matt Fizzell? I mean, and this
I
isn't
did not.
This is okay. Yeah, this was not to put you on the spot. Like, oh, thanks for not listening to my show, Rob. see you never.
But I listen to it all the time, Jersey.
And now, as do everybody who I respect. No. Little ad. No, but
I do listen to it actually, but I'm a bit behind. Three, four episodes behind.
And that's why I asked. I didn't want to leap into talking about it and like have you go, oh, I don't know what you're talking about. One of the things Matt Madden talks about on the show is like this, and I'm blanking on what it's called. He does this thing where he takes a really rigid poetic structure. He calls this the comics sestina, I think is what he calls it. It's this really rigid poetic structure where like certain words get rearranged in a certain order by like almost algorithmically in each stanza. And he said, well, why can't this be done in a comic as an experimentation to like sort of like parse out how the meaning changes when you rearrange panels and with the same drawings or with the same moment choices or whatever. And so, yeah. I linked to it in the show notes. It's at comicsaregreat.com/CAG23. And he does this as a class thing, or he does this as his own experiment. And I was thinking like even doing something where you take like a haiku, take like a poet, you know, this reminds me of like how, you know, I hinted earlier about this idea of like children's cartoons. It has a structure. It has a certain kind of structure, and there are certain parameters you're operating within, and working within those limitations creates some really great stuff. And so like, yeah, is every cartoon from, you know, 20 years ago good? No. Some people do it poorly. Some people do it less effectively. Some people do it beautifully. And when they do it beautifully, it becomes like a kind of poetry, because there are certain things you expect to find there, and there they are. There's those rhythmic things. There's those structural things. And there's even some like content things in there. Some like subjective things that you find repeating throughout them. But it's, if you look at it as poetry, it's not it's not silly. It's not derivative. It's not dumbed down. It's actually really beautifully executed ideas within a very strict structure. I can imagine doing things like that too, right? Like take a structure from some kind of poetry, or take a structure from some kind of like even a music. Like think about like music has like different kinds of beats, right? You got 4/4 time, 3/3 time.
Absolutely. So yeah, you could do visual, audible mapping kind of things or whatnot, and mix it up with. This is kind of wandering into the territory of generative art, right?
Yeah.
Except instead of having a computer put it out based on here's some resources and an algorithm, and now run and see what happens. That's cool, right? So a lot like if you've ever seen like the a Game of Life demonstration, where sort of there's a simulation that's being visualized that plays out over. Are you familiar with this, Jersey?
Mm-mm.
Where essentially you've got a grid of possibly really cool looking things, possibly kind of plain little lit up squares or blocks, or they're glowy balls or whatever, however they're visualizing it. But each thing in the grid represents like a piece of a piece of food or a living creature or whatever. And then the creatures can exist in such and such a dense population, but not too dense, and then they die off if there's not enough of them and whatever. So you just see this art just grow and then fill up and then ebb and flow, and it just kind of animates in front of you, right?
I think I've seen an iPhone app that does this where like there's like it's like a grid of squares, mm-hmm. and there's like the algorithmic rules are that like a square can only exist in so many quadrants of another square, and you have to have at least two squares in this configuration of squares in order for the society to continue. And then you hit run and you watch it change, you watch it grow into like this moving picture of it morphing and growing out and then retracting, and then eventually it'll stop when it gets to the point where it's exhausted all the possible iterations of that sequence of rules. Is that what you're talking about?
Or can reach a point of perfect stability.
Or perfect stability. Yeah, that's another way to put it. Yeah, thank you.
And anyway, so what's interesting about this is it's a lot like generative art, where you have these rules and limitations, except you get the extra, this human factor twist, where you get to sort of, you know, whatever comes out of, you know, your pen and your thoughts as you quote unquote run this algorithm, right? And chances are you're exposing yourself to a chance to have a fun learning experience.
Yeah, to be surprised by something you created, right?
Exactly. By seeing, because you can hear the result of being like, oh, okay, we're going to draw something related to what would a farm be like in an anti-gravity situation, but with cartoon rules or something, right?
Yeah.
And then we're going to have these, I don't know, that's probably an overcomplicated example, but you come up with the scenario and you play it out. And even though you hear the scenario, you may have this rough picture in mind, but you don't know exactly what's going to happen until you do it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And then creating rules like that, as long as you frame it properly, like call it a scrimmage in a game, not work.
Yes. As opposed to your daily burden.
Your daily burden. That's what we should have called it.
Well, okay, now we're doing it ironically. So, yeah, there you go. It's my daily burden.
Put on your yoke of shame. It's time to draw. Yep.
Exactly.
Everybody gets a lanyard that just says shame on it.
Yep, my pencil says never good enough with a sad face.
And then, like everybody gets like an 8x10 glossy of a picture of a disapproving mother. So yeah, there's a lot of places to go with a challenge. And I figure we're probably going to wind up instigating some of these, but then also then the users themselves, like the participants, are going to instigate some of these games. And that's going to be something really, I'm going to look forward to quite a bit.
Yeah. I mean, that's the ultimate metagame, is when we're all collaborating together to perpetuate this experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. So, hey, speaking of things we're going to do, where do we stand with what's going on with leanintoart.com? Let me do that again, because people never catch the URLs. I'm going to try to do a little vocal trick. Leanintoart.com. You think anybody picked up on that one?
Well, either I that picked like, up they, on that you said leanintoart.com.
Either that or they stopped listening.
Exactly. Like, you guys, cut that out.
I hate it when Jersey does that.
Anyway.
So you just yeah, did, so that, you did some website. Neat stuff. You did some neat stuff that I want to talk about.
Oh, that's cool. It got lost in the, I don't know, the drudgery of my daily burden, but I don't know.
I'm writing this down. This is going to be a t-shirt, my daily burden. Oh.
So, yeah, I don't know. We're doing a lot to get the word out there about 30 classes in 30 days. So there is a super cool, fresh, funky, awesome page that we put up there.
Let me break up my 90s hip hop to play in the background while you're talking about this.
Parents just don't understand. Wait, that's 80s. Oops.
Oh, you wash your face in my sink?
So, let's see. Yeah, we have we did a big announcement at leanintoart.com/30-classes-in-30-days.
Actually, and, I redirected the URL 30 classes 30 days to that page.
So you just, super handy. So yeah, you can just go to 30classes30days.com and land in this wonderful place where we where we're highlighting our preliminary list of instructors. And our preliminary list of topics and how we're structuring this whole event with, we're going to have, you know, of course we mentioned before the live workshops, the time shifted ones, and then, some labs, right? Which are sort of these, round tables driven both by what the, presenters bring and what the audience asks. And it all adds up to, you know, for every day in the month of November, it'll be like you go to this art center online and you can take another class, a brand new class every single day. and then we have our few different, pricing levels out there, gold, silver, and bronze.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. And we should mention about the early bird cutoff is, September 23rd. Is that right?
Yes. Early bird cutoff for, the discounted prices is September 23rd. And there's other things coming together on the site too. What would you like to bring folks' attention to, Jersey?
Oh, I wanted to talk about how you've been at work developing the workshop content pages. That's under development, right? So that's something that you're going to see if you've already registered. You're going to start seeing some things changing on that. We're building the thing. I mean, we're pumping out this podcast and some other content on the site well in advance. I mean, what is this? We're at the end of August right now. This thing doesn't launch till November. So, you know, we're kind of building the infrastructure now for the launch. And one of the things that you spent a lot of time on was, building these workshop landing pages with really great access, like great ways to access the content. We don't have to go into all the specifics on it, but just pointing people at something to watch out for, right? Like when they log in, what are they going to see?
Oh, sure. They will see, I mean, the whole site is sort of just content will be popping up and sort of blooming everywhere with each workshop will get its own landing page. The collection of workshops page will be evolving. We'll be working on also pages as well for our podcasts, because we got quite a list of them already. And it'd be nice to highlight the differences between them and sort of, give them a proper presentation. Right.
Yeah.
And of course, actually our instructors as well.
That's right. We've already got confirmations from some pretty awesome people. Do we want to highlight a couple? Who do we got? Yeah. Krishna said, Asvam, PCWeenies.com. I mean, this guy, he's got credibility. He teaches at the Art Institute of Tampa. He teaches, storytelling and visual design, and this guy knows his stuff, right?
Oh yeah, he covers quite the gambit of topics in his teaching. And I saw him speak at the Up Fair on doing character design. That was a lot of fun watching him go through his different methods that he uses. And
I didn't get to see that.
Oh, yeah.
bum out. But yeah, I'm super stoked about having him on board. So Krishna Sadasvam, there's value enough. Done. We don't have to mention anybody else.
You heard it from us, Krishna. You're carrying the load for everybody.
For all of us. If this thing passes or fails, it's all on Krishna. I'm going to call you to the board. No, Brandon Dayton is also signed on of brandondayton.com. Anybody who's ever listened to Comics Are Great has heard him talk before. He's been in a handful of the roundtable episodes that I did on the show before I moved it to the Ann Arbor District Library. Great thinker on comic storytelling. Super stoked about that. Who else did we get?
Awesome.
Who else has signed the dotted line?
Let's see. We've got Jonathan Rector.
Jonathan Rector. JonathanRector.com. That's right. Of Scribbles with Jonathan. He does a YouTube show called Scribbles with Jonathan where he teaches how to draw. So there's another good one.
Oh, yeah. And then actually, my wife, Kate Shield-Stenzinger, officially signed on as well.
A little bit of nepotism never hurt.
No, not.
Hey, kidding. Know, I'm kidding.
Sometimes creative people marry other creative people.
No.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I learned it by watching you.
Oh, is that what
it? No, I. which is, that's, you know, that's joking, but obviously you and your wife, Anne, are a very creative couple. But actually, I was also commenting about the Comics Are Great that I did catch part of live with Christopher Hastings.
Yeah,
another creative couple.
No, I think that's a really good idea. If you're a creative person, is try to seek out a fellow creative person. I mean, you know, opposites attract and all that, and there's the possibility that you'll get a richer relationship as a result of that. But I never had good luck dating girls who were not creative. I got a lot of the whole why are you wasting your time with that silly stuff? You know.
Oh yeah, You're putting your effort into creative projects, and that can be a lot of effort depending on the project, right?
Yep. I mean,
making comics, man, there's a lot of hours that can go into every page there.
Yeah.
Takes an understanding person to stick around.
Yeah. Well, and understanding not just in the sense of this is something I will endure for out of my love of this person, but understanding in the sense of, oh yeah, I totally know what you're doing because I want to do something similar. Right.
Exactly. And support them in the same way.
Yep. But also having a lot of conversations with non-creative girlfriends, like, you know, not everything is fodder for a story. You know, not everything needs to be unboxed for fuel for your creative endeavors. Just experience some things sometimes. You know, I got a lot of that kind of talk.
Yeah.
So.
Well, you know, this is an excellent section of the podcast. I mean, we've got the whole relationship angle, right?
Is that what we're going to do? We're going to do like relationship advice?
No.
Do not come to me for that. I'll tell you what.
No, oh, me either.
Here's my advice. Passively wait for her to get sick of you and then you can go on and move on to a different girlfriend. Worked for me. No, I'm kidding.
Excellent.
No, that's very bad advice.
Oh, no, I know.
So,
yes.
I don't know how we got on that.
We're talking about the nepotism of my wife.
That's right.
Being
Kate,
one of the
yes. I totally steamrolled that. Please, let's talk about Kate because she is bringing some really interesting stuff to the thing.
I mean, she's involved in both. Well, she her degree is in psychology with the focus on children's health and child psychology and all that. And she's had this focus of play and creativity throughout that and with, you know, activities and, you know, things for fun, not just for kids, but for whole families. And so she's actually working on a workshop that's all about creative families. So
there we go.
More info on that coming up. But,
you know, and this is another thing that I think is really cool is like having this really wide sort of casting the net wide on everything that is related to the creative arts. I was just having a conversation the other day with the guy who was telling me he's got a son on the way in like the next couple months. And he was telling me how he's like, you know, it really bummed me out when I thought about the fact that there's no Saturday morning cartoons anymore. He's like, so I'm gonna have to make mixed CDs and I'm going to play them on Saturdays so I can watch Saturday morning cartoons with my kid the way I got to watch them when I was a kid. And And I, first of all, that's just cool because I love cartoons. But what I thought was really cool was that he was making a concerted effort to watch it with his kid. And not just to be like, you know, the pat advice of like, you know, be involved in your child's life and all that stuff. But I told him that one of the things, one of the defining things that I think made me turn out the way I did is that when I was a little kid, and I'm talking like 82, so what was that, like in second grade? What is that, 8? Something like that? 7, 8? My dad would watch Saturday morning cartoons with me, but then he would talk with me about them afterwards. And not like a breakdown of story construction or anything like that, but he would just have a discussion with me about like what was good, what was bad. You know, like, oh, was it cool when Plastic Man did such and such? And I'd be like, oh, yeah. So like at an early stage, I was already thinking about story. Like my dad like kind of got the ball rolling with me, like unboxing this stuff and understanding that it was okay to like it so much that I wanted to talk about it for an hour afterwards, you know? And so like where I'm going with this is like this whole idea of like creativity in the home is like one of the things I also hope we can do with this Lean Into Art Jazz is provide content for people who want to have, you know, creativity, not just in their studio. And now it's time to come out and be dad again or mom again, for that matter. But like, you know, have a lifestyle where everything you do amounts to some kind of positive. Oh, is enrichment a bad word, Rob? I don't know.
Enrichment of uranium?
Yes, it's a bad thing. If you want to put some yellow cake into the kids' lunchbox,
honestly, no. Actually, okay. Being, you know, learning is fun, dude. So
I know I'm
in the same boat as you. But the enrichment part of like activities in school was always the stuff I wanted to do first.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to do the rest of the activity, but I wanted to do the enrichment. So anyway, I think it's an awesome thing.
But yeah, yeah, like, because that gets, how many times have I been surprised working with, you know, second graders or third graders in a classroom where something they did surprised me that informed my own art, right? So that's another, like, benefit. Like, if you're going to get it, why do this kind of stuff? Well, by doing this stuff at home with your kids, you're also going to be improving yourself as an artist, and your kid's going to think you're pretty rad when they get old. They're going to go through that period when they're 15 where they're like, shut up, dad. Shut up, mom. You suck. You don't know anything. I know what life's all about. But then when they turn 19, they're going to be like, oh, you know, I'm glad they did that. Although your kid's not going to do that.
I have no idea. We'll see.
I'll get back to you in 12 years.
Exactly. Who knows when that would kick in. Right now, I mean, she definitely enjoys her daddy and she, you know, could probably have 10 ponies if she asked because she does stuff like, what the heck? This is another trial of content on the podcast. But if, for instance, we went camping as a family recently. And one of the things we did is we actually, on the north shore of Lake Superior, there's a lot of the shore is made up of rocks that are anything between like pebble sized to, you know, car sized. But there's quite a bit that are in between that form the beach that are, you know, you could hold like about 5 in your hand. Right.
Yeah.
And so they had rocks like that, that, my wife and a lot of the kids that were there, including, our daughter, actually did some painting on the rocks and then added, googly eyes to them and stuff. So it was fun to watch.
Oh, cool.
And got some cool pictures of that. I might end up that, you know, not no spoilers. I mean, I think some of those things will end up in Kate's workshop, actually. But
with somebody who has the background to be able to communicate to you why you're doing this. This isn't just about like, here's something to set the kids off doing while you go have a cup of coffee and gossip with your neighbor, you know. This isn't Mad Men. This is about like, you know, actually being involved and like you are having as much fun as they are in doing the thing, right?
Oh yeah. And yeah, she can relate the various positive development aspects of that activity. For me, I got to watch them paint rocks and it looked fun. And I helped out and, you know, made sure the paint didn't fall over. Stuff like that.
So you were the AV guy.
Yeah, there you go. I was AV
guy. So I hope Kate will forgive me for steamrolling over her introduction by saying nepotism, because it's totally not.
No.
I'm just anticipating, suspicion from an audience and trying to respond to it as quickly as possible.
Yeah, indeed. We share the same last name, and yep, there's a reason for that.
We're brother and sister.
Nope.
Oh, well, it is Minnesota.
Hey.
Sorry.
We're from the city.
I know, the Twin Cities, that's right. No, actually, being from Michigan and being from Central Michigan, I'm the one who is more likely to have to say that than you. So, anyway, okay. I think if the bad jokes start rolling, it's time to go. Close it. Wrap it up. So we're gonna do another one of these in the very near future. I can promise you that. And talk about more. So if people want to email us a topic they want us to crunch over top of, do we want to throw out an email address at them?
Oh, yeah. Well, we do in the closing of the show.
Oh, that's right.
On top of it, we will experiment with a live audience at some point here, too.
Yeah. Yep. I have every intention of doing so. So yeah. We're just playing around with different technologies and formats. We're recording this one not in Adobe Connect, but in Ableton Live, just to see if we get a little bit richer sound this time. And you guys can let us know what you think, what you prefer. But we'll probably goof around with lots of different ways to do this. Because at this early stage of the game, this is the time to, you know, grow all those different fins and see which ones help us swim better. And then whichever ones don't work, throw them out.
Yeah, either that or I might not stop growing fins, Jersey, just to forewarn you.
You'll just be covered in vestigial organs and appendages.
You know, I said that to myself about my Project Art Geek Zoo, and yeah. It changes every chapter. So yeah. Yeah. Likely the experimentation will continue.
Oh, good. That'll keep it fun for me at least. Okay. Well, good talk, Rob.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Jersey. It's been cool.
There, we did our introductions. So until next time, everybody, I've been Jersey Drozd. You can find more information about me at jdrozd.com or follow me on Twitter, Jersey. I'm also on the Google Plus at Jersey Drozd or plus Jersey Drozd. What about you, Rob?
I've been Rob Stenzinger, and you can follow me at Twitter with all one word, Rob Stenzinger. And I'm also at how about artgeekzoo.com.
Where you can find links to everything else, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, there we go. So click around, have fun, and keep leaning, everybody. Okay, bye.
Show notes for this episode can be found at leanintoart.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at the user leanintoart, and you can reach us via email at leanintoart@gmail.com. When you lean it, you know you mean it. Thanks for listening.